This is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Hello, gang. How we doing? There is an assumption that I think many of us make, which is that work and spirituality, for lack of a better term, are necessarily, definitionally separate, even opposed. This is a huge theme for me in my own life and in the content I create. How to bring the lessons I've learned from meditation, psychology, and Buddhism into the crucible of my work life. How to be sanely productive. How to be ambitious without driving myself nuts. How to figure out how much money is enough money. My guest today has been thinking deeply about this stuff for way longer than I have. His name is David Nickturn. He believes that business can be, and these are his words, an essential spiritual practice. He's been practicing and teaching meditation for over 40 years. He's the author of a book called Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, and he hosts a podcast by the same name. He's an interesting dude. He began his career as a successful composer, producer, and guitarist. He's recorded and played with Stevie Wonder, Jerry Garcia, Lana Del Rey, Paul Simon, and many others. He actually wrote that classic song, Midnight at the Oasis. He's the guy who wrote that. More recently, he's become an entrepreneur, founding an online mindfulness-based education platform called Dharma Moon. I found this conversation to be very helpful because I'm wrestling with a lot of this stuff at the moment. David Nickturn coming up. But first, some BSP, blatant self-promotion. Just to say real quick, don't forget to check out danharris.com, my new website, where you can sign up for my newsletter, which I haven't been promoting that hard because we've been honing it in the background. But now I really feel good about it. And it's a place where I sum up the key learnings for me from the week's episodes and also make a bunch of cultural recommendations, whatever books and TV shows and movies I'm enjoying right now. Go check it out, danharris.com. We also have a new merch store where you can buy 10% happier gear and also some gear festooned with my profanity-laced slogans, danharris.com. Meanwhile, over on the 10% Happier app, from Monday, May 13th to Sunday, May 19th, we're going to be celebrating World Meditation Week with a whole series of free meditations available right there on the app. Every day, something new and unique designed to help beginners and seasoned meditators. And because we're so excited about it, we're going to be offering 40% off the subscription price until the end of May. Head over to 10%.com/40. That's 10% spelled out, .com/40 to get started. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger, never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. David Nickturn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's really good to be here with you. I've watched your show quite a bit. I'm excited to talk to you.
Likewise. So you've written a bunch of books and other things, but what I want to talk about today is creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Would you think it would be fair to describe that book as Buddhist career advice?
No. the way I would describe it is, if you took those three strands, those three sort of aspects of living, and you developed a braid with them, or attempted to integrate them into one cohesive way of being. That's what the book's about. So it's not just how to make money teaching Dharma. It's not how to make a business more ethical and aligned. And it's not how to get your demos recorded by Taylor Swift necessarily either. But any of those could be part of it.
So Dharma, Buddhism is part of it, but it's one strand among three.
That's right. And what we say is they have equal weight, which is an unconventional perspective.
Say more about how you think it's unconventional.
Well, just in my experience, people are stronger in one of those three suits than the other, or maybe two. So if you put two together, something that I started off my music career with was a very famous songwriter telling me that music business was two words. You know, you're putting those two things together. And there's a lot of people who are very talented who have not put those two things together. At the same time, there's a lot of, I worked in the nonprofit world for many, many years, you know, working for $25 a week as the director of a meditation center in Vermont, after living in Mulholland Drive in Los Angeles and scoring films and producing hit records. So the nonprofit world has also eschewed kind of, and, you know, poo-pooed the kind of what I would call the quote-unquote real world, and vice versa. So I think we've arrived at a time where people are trying to really balance their tires on those elements of their lifestyle. And that's what we're all about at Dharma Moon. That's our project.
So it is important to be creative. That's the magic. It's important to make a buck because you've got bills. And it's important to have ethics and Dharma and Buddhism in there as a way to be as happy as possible, because that will support the other two pillars, and because you want to do things that are good for the world.
Yeah. And I would say we call it CSM for short, the CSM world. I would say you're a perfect candidate. I'd like to invite you to come onto my podcast and talk about how you do it.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I mean, I think one of the things I'd like to talk about today, but I don't want to lead with this, but is where the lines are, where it's appropriate to be making what, you know, X amount of dollars if at its core, what your product is Dharma or Dharma adjacent. And that's something that I've spent some time worrying about, but we'll get to that. Let me just stay at a high level with you first. You say there are two core principles in the book. One of them is as it is, and the other is up to us. Can you pick one and then the other and walk us through them?
Well, you know, different language for depending on how somebody receives this information, but as it is in Sanskrit would be dharmata, suchness, the things the way they are, which is one of the big core tenets of the Buddhist teachings, is you don't get to recontour reality because of your wishful thinking. For example, you can't wishful thinking your way out of old age, sickness, and death. That was a big part of the Buddhist teachings. So you have to deal with life knowing that it's impermanent and that you're going to get old, sick, and die. So that's as it is. That's a very blunt kind of reckoning with things the way that they are. And it involves, to some extent, cutting through, you know, kind of dreamy, fantasy-based, either spiritual or material outlook. It's blunt. It's direct. As it is very direct. It is what it is.
And up to us.
Up to us means, okay, well, with that premise, with that ground, there's a lot of choices that we make. And even if you think you're in a safe, secure channel for following along with somebody who says it's this way, it's that way, really the most intelligent thing a good teacher can tell you is that it's up to you to find your way. And I believe that's what Buddha did. And all the teachers I've studied with have also said that. It's your call. And the way my teacher used to say it is, your guess is as good as mine. That's a powerful thing to hear from somebody you hope is going to have a better guess than you have.
Sometimes the way I think about this, and this is probably amateurish, and so feel free to correct me, but like we're all born unsolicited into this torrent of causes and conditions. And so many things are out of our control. Even the contents of our own mind, that's often out of our control. And yet, even within this flux, we do have some agency. And that's where you get into things like karma. And again, and I have a to the extent that I understand karma at all, it's sort of a very naturalistic, not metaphysical understanding of actions bring results. So anyway, does that gumbo of words make any sense to you?
Yeah, and it's you're moving through a very creative zone to contemplate, how did we get here? What is happening? And how much agency do we have? What kind of agency do we have to change our own mind and understand our own mind? And what kind of agency do we have to affect the bigger picture? So those are really good questions. And I like the fact that you're taking that as a gateway into understanding karma, which is a very powerful concept. My other book is about karma. It's called Awakening from the Daydream. And it's about what karma is, but it is a cascade of causes and conditions resulting in this present moment being set up exactly the way it is. I use the analogy of a billiards game, the lay on the table. Did you used to play pool in college? I did.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lay on the table when you pick up the cue, and you can't really change that unless you're cheating. You get the other person to look the other way, you know, but now you have a shot. You have a clean shot, and you call the shot, and you, depending on how much skill you have, how much mental acuity you've developed, physical acuity, you can affect that shot a lot of different ways, actually. You have a lot of potency in that moment. If you get overwhelmed by emotional upheavals that are conditioned into you, you know, your basic habitual patterns, the shot is going to, you know, be governed by the previous conditions as opposed to having a clean shot. So that's what we're trying to get our mind clean so we can get a clean shot with the existing conditions. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think I can imagine some people bumping on or getting caught on getting your mind clean because one of the big pernicious misconceptions around meditation is that it somehow requires you to clear your mind, which as far as I know is impossible.
It's not impossible.
Say more.
It's not the path that one sets out in the beginning because the first step is to make friends with the mind, as you know, all the, you know, the Vipassana teachings that you've taken. You don't set up the mind as an enemy that you're going to try to conquer, right? However, there can be over time some subsiding in the volume and irregularity and rabbit hole kind of quality of the mind, and the mind can become more steady and more clear. There's no doubt about that. When you're with a great masterful, you know, somebody who's mastered meditation, their mind feels quite clear and stable and steady.
Yes.
It's observable. It's experienceable. No?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I guess we're, as I understand it, and I am not a meditation master, and so I've never inhabited the mind of one either, thoughts still come. And one of the, back to this idea of like, pernicious misconceptions. One of the problems that I run into in talking to people about meditation is they think that as long as thoughts are coming, they're failing.
Yeah, that's a big problem. You're right.
Yes.
That's a big problem. And that's a beginner's problem. And what we would say, you know, in our world would be start by making friends with what the mind, the way it actually is when you sit down on the cushion and be gentle and kind towards yourself. No doubt about it. That's right.
It's amazing how many years I heard those very instructions and did not fucking listen. It took well over a decade for that to sink in.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever heard the expression knucklehead? We're all knuckleheads in that way. We just can't hear what we can't hear and we don't know what we don't know. And it's amazing that the best gift you could ever give yourself is compassion towards yourself about that and towards other people. It takes time. It takes time. And, you know, all fairness, your teachers at some point should give feedback saying, hey, you've made a little progress there. That's okay. They're more ruthless because they're, you know, going like, okay, you know, but my teachers have been incredibly kind to me, actually. At the same time, undercutting, you know, maybe false conceptions that I didn't need anymore. But I think kindness is the biggest quality of a masterful teacher. Mm-hmm. It's what I've seen consistently over and over again in accomplished people is they're kind.
Yes. And kindness doesn't always mean, and this is relevant to many of the other things we're going to discuss within a work context, kindness doesn't always manifest in the stereotypical understanding of kindness, which is like niceness and yeah. treacly sweetness. Kindness can take many forms.
You know, Dan, I don't know if you study this particular teaching. There's so many wonderful teachings under the Buddhist umbrella, but there's one called the Four Skillful Actions, Skillful Means. And the notion is that compassion can create different forms of expression in terms of how you act, how you behave. And they're basically pacifying, enriching, magnetizing, and destroying. Have you ever heard this teaching, those four karmas?
No. Tell me more.
It's called the Four Karmas. And, you know, it's probably associated with the tantric tradition, where you move into action as an expression of compassion, skillful means and compassion being the two crossed elements of it. But sometimes you just are being kind by being pacifying and allowing and leaving space for somebody. That's kindness. And sometimes enriching is the action where you encourage them and you give them a, you know, kind of leg up and a sense of, yeah, you could do it, you know, and you know, tell somebody to appreciate what they have, that kind of situation. The magnetizing is sometimes people get alienated and they just feel they can't come in enough, close enough to the fire, and you just invite them in. And the destroying one is the one you're talking about a little bit. We renamed it direct. You just tell the truth in a precise way. It's surgical. It's swift. I've seen it from both sides, and it looks like the person delivering it is very kind, but the person receiving it might feel kind of cut or penetrated or even provoked. But that's a form of kindness too.
Because it's a useful provocation, a constructive provocation.
Yeah, you're trying to help the person. Your motivation is pure in that sense, you know? Mm.
Let's keep ticking through, because there are many ideas in this book of yours. You talk about manifestation. Just by way of some background here, this is a bit of a running debate we've had on the show between me and two teachers who come on quite a bit, Sebane Selassie and Jeff Warren, who are very close friends of mine. And they both would argue that there is something to this idea of manifestation. I am hung up on having spent a lot of time when I was a network news correspondent, when I would cover self-help hucksters who were selling this idea that you can manifest anything you want through the power of your thoughts, the power of positive thinking, the law of attraction, which in my view is a very dangerous thing to be telling people. You can cure your breast cancer by just thinking positively, or yeah, you can get that diamond necklace, et cetera, et cetera. So when you talk about manifestation, what are you referring to?
It's such a good point. What's interesting, Dan, is I feel like your arc is a little bit like aligned with the idea of cutting through spiritual materialism, that idea. Your voice has a kind of quality of, let's not just buy into all this new age stuff and you know, wishful thinking stuff. So I appreciate that. And it's my heart's blood, the cutting through spiritual materialism. You know, let's not use this as just another way to manipulate and kind of build up the ego structure. But manifesting, so what I mean by manifesting is what we talk about in the book is joining heaven and earth. That's the metaphor I use, and that's a classical metaphor. So you have some kind of vision, like, for example, in your case, this podcast, you must have visualized it first. You have to have visualized it first, and then you manifested it. So it's as simple as that.
I'm laughing because you give me give me more credit than I deserve, because it was more like I stumbled into it, if I'm honest. But your point is well taken.
Yeah. I mean, even going forward, like, and this is what I do a lot with people. I coach a lot with people one-to-one. Like, okay, well, what is this podcast going to look like in 3 years? And it's not that you come up with a rigid version of it, but you allow yourself to visualize and dream a little bit about a form. And then you connect it to the earth in terms of, like, you know, getting the right team together. You have a great team. They know what they're doing. Your sound guy, Kevin, knows what he's doing. If he didn't, you're not manifesting your vision. You know, you'd have to make some shifts on the earth level to manifest. So all I mean is just putting something on the road. You know, the Tesla, it's out there. You can drive them. I was in LA and my friend took off the automatic driving thing and I freaked out completely. You know, this car is driving itself through LA. Can you imagine that? That's sort of a manifestation of something.
To you, because the way you're describing it sounds quite earthy, naturalistic. Do you think that there's a metaphysical, magical component to it?
What a great question. And I do have another chapter in the book. I mean, I felt like I put it down in that book. I laid my experience out for anybody who wanted to know like what I was into. And there's a chapter called Auspicious Coincidence, which is a favorite topic of mine, called Tendril in Tibetan, T-E-N-D-R-E-L. And I can tell some stories about those things, and you could too. I'm sure all the folks here could. It means that things happen with a little bit of a sparkle to them when you're tuned up well. And you might bump into just the right person at the right time, or the right thing happens. So I'll give you an example. Can I give an example of it?
Please, please.
Yeah, so Joni Mitchell is on my mind right now. Maybe not just mine, but did you see her at the Grammys the other night?
I saw a picture of her in my Instagram feed at the Grammys, yes.
Okay, you got to go back and watch the YouTube video of her singing Both Sides Now at the end of this kind of highly steroid plastic, you know, kind of like hyper thing. And she sat in an armchair and sang that song. Everybody's losing their cookies on it. It's just so moving. And it's not because she has that great voice that she used to have. And it's not because she had the sparkle and the energy. She had the wisdom and the depth. So I thought about Joni Mitchell, and I told a friend of mine a story about Joni Mitchell the other day, because that's my crowd. You know, that's, I was, you know, very active in the music world in the 70s, and I was working with Maria Muldaur and Joni Mitchell and Bonnie Raitt and Linda Ronstadt. Those were the kind of divas at that time. Very beautiful, colorful, fun time. And a friend of mine named Robin Ford, who you may know, he's a great guitar player, one of the really great contemporary guitar players, played with Joni on a bunch of her records. He played with Miles Davis. I mean, he's a really accomplished player. And he and I were sitting in a restaurant on 8th Avenue and 54th Street in Manhattan with another friend, another Dharma friend, Michael Carroll. And we go on, there's something called aimless wandering. Have you ever done that practice?
No.
Well, sometime let's do it together, okay? Aimless okay. wandering. Yeah. You just go, okay. You just leave your house and you don't have an agenda. And that's all you have to do. And then things kind of come out of the atmosphere that have highlights in them, and you know, just start to notice things without having an agenda. So we went on one of our aimless wandering kind of jaunts. These two people in my energy sort of tends to ratchet up possibilities in that. So Michael says, okay, there's this little bar on 54th Street, and I go in there and all kinds of crazy stuff happens. And this is right after we were talking about Joni Mitchell in this restaurant, and they were playing her record on the thing. So Joni Mitchell is completely, and Robin was talking about playing with her, and there was all this kind of energy of like Joni Mitchell energy. And then we walk into this bar and she's sitting at the bar. What is that? What is that? That's Tendril. We call that auspicious coincidence. Not just, it's synchronicity, but with a real tilt to it. And I could tell the rest of the story. She was with a guy. She said, whenever I'm with this guy, we always have synchronicity happen. It was just a cascade. So there's a dreamlike quality to that part of our experience. It's pretty cool. You can't count on it. You can't make it happen. You just have to open to it. And what we say in my little gang is listen to the melody of circumstances. Listen to the melody of circumstances. Don't be deaf to it. And know that even if it's not good news, it could have been we got mugged or something like that. Mm. It still has some kind of quality of, if you're tuning into it, you'll get messages that way. So I would say there is a magic element to it. And I have personally experienced it in many ways, no doubt about it.
And can one be a better magician beyond simply tuning the mind and being awake as possible?
That's the path. And also in our tradition, as you know, those are called siddhis, you know, powers that happen.
Powers, yeah.
We don't seek them out. That's a very serious warning to not try to become a magician. You know, you try to just pay attention, be compassionate, always have compassionate motivation. That's very, very important. But if stuff happens, then you use it for the benefit of the whole situation, or you just appreciate it. But if you go after those things, that's a dangerous thing. No doubt about it.
I'm going to say a few things, and I'm saying them to you, but also I'm kind of keeping the audience in mind in case there are people listening who are on the skeptical end of the spectrum. My take on all of this, because there are you know, within the Buddhist tradition, and I consider myself to be a part of that tradition, a relative newcomer, but definitely a part of the tradition. There are, the deeper you get, the more you'll hear about things like iddhis or powers, superpowers, that could be developed through, you know, tuning up your mind in meditation and getting a more concentrated mind. And I was, this will surprise exactly no one, when I first encountered these ideas, completely dismissive. And now I'm respectfully agnostic. And I have no evidence that these things exist. A lot of incredibly smart people who I trust really believe in them. And so I don't take what you or anybody else is saying at face value. I have no personal experience with any of this. And I'm sort of toying with a good-natured openness. Yeah. So does that, how does that all land with you?
It sounds sweet to me and good. And I'm a Jewish guy from New York. I don't know where you're from. Are you from New York?
I live in New York, but I'm a half Jew from Boston.
Okay. I'm a full Jew born in Beth Israel Hospital on First Avenue and 16th Street. And what I mean to say by that, like, I don't mean to, you know, hyper-characterize any ethnic group, but I'm as hard-boiled as it gets in a certain way in terms of buying anything from somebody on the street or whatever. And not only that, my dad was a shrink, and he would talk a lot about magical thinking, you know, which is a thing in the psychiatric world of, like, people buying into these kind of things. So I don't have any, unlike some very good friends of mine, I don't have any investment at all in, oh, it's, you know, Twinkle Toes came and, you know, delivered a, you know, I could care less on a certain level, but I'm telling you things that I've actually seen with my own eyes. And I did have the good fortune of, and I call it dumb luck, of having the Tibetan pantheon land on my head in the early 70s and met all the great lamas of that time. I saw them up firsthand, and they don't emphasize the cities either, but they have them. And there's a lot of kind of significant expansion of what you might think is within the realm of what's practical, but nobody banks on it. They also had more horse sense and more common sense than anybody I know. So those two things together is a hard thing to visualize, like good ass common sense and a sense of magic. I do think they can go together. So you and I could keep talking about that over the years. How about that idea?
I'm in. Yeah. I'm laughing because I'm thinking about something that my teacher's teacher used to say to him. Joseph Goldstein was my teacher. He had a teacher named Munindra, or Munindra G. And Munindra used to say to Joseph, or not to Joseph, because Joseph always believed in this stuff, but he would say to people who didn't believe, you don't have to believe it, but it's true. That always makes me smile. Coming up, David Nickturn talks about how to get clear on your own worth and value and the benefits of looking at your habitual patterns up close, even though it might be painful. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected after investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns. T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile, third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans. The weather is getting warmer. Time to ditch my jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. I used to waste my money on clothing that would only last one season. That was until I found Quince. Now I've got high-quality pieces that never go out of style that I will be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I just made a big order at Quince.com. I got two pairs of sweatpants that I've just had for like a week, and I already love them. I'm wearing them all the time. Sweatpants are a huge deal to me because I work from home and I want to look reasonably good, you know, in front of my wife and stuff, but I want to be comfortable. And the Quince sweatpants do the trick. For me, the bottom line is they've got good looking stuff at low prices. Not a bad recipe. You should go ahead and upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier. Before we get back to the show, a quick reminder, in honor of World Meditation Week, we're offering 40% off a subscription to the 10% Happier app. Head over to 10%.com/40. That's 10% spelled out .com/40 to get started. So let's just go back to business for a second. Not for a second. Let's go back in an abiding way. Your contention in this book is that business can be an essential spiritual practice. Can you say a little bit more about that?
You know, right now we have this platform called Dharma Moon, which is also my son Ethan, who you know is teaching on that platform this point. Yeah. So it is based on the concept of the equal weight of the creative expression, which is something that's not often emphasized in the Dharma world. Like you're a songwriter or you're an artist or something like that. They don't give that a lot of weight. The spiritual practice and the business practice. So the course that we're teaching right now is called Creativity, Spirituality, and Prosperity. I just took it a little. And the Eightfold Path, which is the biggest iteration of what you're supposed to do as a Buddhist. You're supposed to walk on the Eightfold Path. What's in there? Right livelihood is right in there. Right speech, right view, right intention. You know, what do they mean by right? I mean, like, have your head screwed onto your body. You know, be a good person, be decent, be straightforward, be accountable for yourself. It's just basic guidance for living. So where else could you practice that better than in the business world, where you spend 8 to 10 hours of your waking day? And either you become divorced from all that and you develop some kind of split world, schismatic world, or you bring it to work with you and you bring church to work with you. Yeah. And that to me seems entirely important for our world right now. That schism seems to need to be healed right now. Yeah. That's my view.
I agree with you. And I just say for myself, it was my suffering in a professional context that brought me to meditation and Buddhism in the first place.
And you were very brave to share that with the world. That took a lot of gumption, I think, if you don't mind me saying so.
Oh, thank you.
To open your heart in that way and your experience, and other people resonate with that. And they go, okay, this guy's honest. He's not just throwing some idealized version of himself out there. And you know who else did that? Mingyur Rinpoche. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but.
I am. Yeah, I am. He's been on the show a couple times.
You know, people should be honest about where they're at and then go from there. So I think bringing that into the business world, now, it might shift. I wonder, did it shift your venue? Like, do you still work in that same world or not so much anymore?
No, I retired a little over 2 years ago from the news world, and now I'm a full-time, I don't know what I am, but not that.
But you know what? Here's a funny thing. You're also a young, from my perspective, you're a young man. You know, it's funny how that goes. I think you probably don't think that, right? You think you're pretty far along or something?
I'm 52 and my son is always pointing at me. I have a 9-year-old son who's constantly pointing out how gray I am. So I don't feel that young.
Yeah, but you're not that old either, in my humble opinion. And I wrote that book that we're talking about at the age of 71.
Huh.
And I wrote my first book, Awakening from the Daydream, at 67. And I started dharmamoon.com. At 72, we're 3 years old, this company, and we're building a whole company with a very adventurous concept behind it, which is to not do the Dharma, but include it in a very open way that includes creative juice. Because, you know, my whole life has been in the entertainment business. That's where I've been. So I'm still in it. I'm in it, out of it. I've had, you know, incredible experiences there. I like to say that my life started off in the early 70s, going back and forth between studying with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and learning about Buddhism and playing in a bluegrass band with Jerry Garcia. That's my life. And it's been like that ever since, really.
You've learned a lot in that period of time, and you're sharing it in your book and now in this interview with us. So let's go through some of your principles. One of them is never negotiate against yourself. Can you say a little bit more about that one?
I'm so thrilled that you're bringing these things up, because a lot of thought went into like encapsulating whatever, you know, experience and perspective. So that is something actually my lawyer, my music business lawyer, taught me. She was a great mentor, and I had some serious opportunities at a fairly young age. You know, I had a big hit record when I was like 26 years old. I was nominated for 2 Grammys before I even knew what was going on. I'm sitting there, you know, and Paul Simon and John Lennon are making the presentation. You know, it was like a very exciting time. And then I had opportunities that came up to write film scores. I wrote some film scores. And we'd go into the negotiation, and Judy Berger is her name. She'd say, David, don't negotiate against yourself. And I think the simple meaning of that is let the other person do that. That's their job. That's not your job, is to undercut yourself. So it doesn't mean you have an arrogant sense, but you have a sense of your own value and your own worth. And you also try to align that with the situation and make a good deal for yourself in any context. You know, I went from making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on Mulholland Drive to making $25 a month as the director of a meditation center in Vermont, which is where Ethan took his first steps in that cafeteria. And both were good deals as far as I'm concerned. So it's not so much about like how much you make or, you know, it's the holistic aspect of the negotiation. But you should not undercut yourself. Let the other person take a swipe and then hold your seat, you know, and hold your dignity back, and then be fluid. That's my advice to anybody negotiating.
I think this gets into some complex and interesting, juicy areas around confidence and knowing your worth. On my side, I sometimes mess up. I cross the line between, you know, a grounded understanding of knowing my worth and an inflated sense of my own value. And a lot of people I know, and this is a generalization, but many of them are women. And I think I can safely speak for my wife on this score. Don't have a grounded enough sense of their own value and come into negotiations and negotiate against themselves. So this idea of confidence and knowing your own value and your own worth, it can be messed up in lots of different ways. There's a lot of suffering on the menu in this particular restaurant.
Yeah. Well, and the general topic is self-assessment, which is an important part of our teacher training program. Everybody has to learn to self-assess. And you could either be ruthless with yourself, which a lot of people are. Let's face it, a lot of people are too hard on themselves. Or you could have an inflated sense of self-worth. But usually that's predicated on diminished sense of self-worth, right directly underneath it often, right?
Right.
And I take your point about in the current social setting over the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a real shift in terms of empowering women in the workplace. I've been part of that. I was raised by that. My mother was the first woman producer on Broadway to win a Tony Award. I grew up with like the early stages of that, what we're talking about. And I like to coach men and women about what you're talking about. And maybe you're right. The masculine perspective is can do, and maybe the female perspective is a little more vulnerable, but they can also switch, right? It's not gender related. It's more like mentality related. No?
I think it's also part like how people are socialized and in this, you know, there's no shortage, I think, of residual sexism in the overarching culture. And those messages insinuate their way into the minds of people. So I don't know if it's something essential about gender, but there's something, I think, pretty obvious about how it's expressed in the culture now.
Yeah, the culture is shifting right now, no doubt about it. And I, you know, I've been alive kind of a significant amount of time. It feels like that. Anyhow, I'm going to be 76 in 2 weeks, you know. And you look at it, you go, what has shifted in my lifetime? And I would say the paradigm you're talking about is in a serious shift mode right now as the result of the last 30 years of, you know, a lot of people putting energy into it. I love it. I'll go on record as saying we have a lot of women on our team. I like powerful women. I'm comfortable around that notion. I think it's changing. And watch out, everybody. You may not be able to rely on the old paradigm. If you need to cling to that, you better let go now.
Yep. Let's go back to self-assessment, though. What are some ways we can think about arriving at a grounded sense of our value that's neither inflated nor deflated?
Soften. Just be soft. Be tender. There's a lot of things, even body movement, that you soften into. I've been studying Tai Chi for 30 years. I love it. And it's all about softening. There's very little about that's tightening up, you know. So if you look at our physical model for strength, it's exoskeletal, you know. So I think if you want to find your self-assessment, if you just exhale, soften, allow yourself to feel yourself, you know, all those kind of things, you'll get there. And even if you're arrogant, that's a good thing to do, you know. I don't see it happening much with arrogant people. They don't soften. They don't pause. They don't rest. They don't yield. So I think it is the ascendance of what I would call feminine wisdom, you know, just loosely calling it that, but really receptive energy, just receive. Mm-hmm. So then notice your body. I think that's really been a good one to feel your body right now, even just where's the tension? What are you fighting? What are you holding on to? And release that and be willing to cry, be willing to be soft, be willing to be wrong, all those things. We could use it, don't you think? The world?
Yes. This is not my phrase, but it's been pointed out that we're living in a pandemic of certainty.
Yeah, well, of course, there's so many expressions. I just did a podcast with Duncan Trussell, who I know has been on your show too. And
yeah, love that guy.
Yeah, me too. He's a serious attempt to be himself and also to learn. That's a rare blend of authenticity and sort of receptivity that don't always go together. But we called it beginner's mind. That was the last night we had an info session for our upcoming teacher training program, and he joined us. And we were talking about beginner's mind, which is, you know, I think you know, is from the Zen tradition. And it was a book by Suzuki Roshi, a very famous early book in the iteration of Buddhism in the West called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. In the expert's mind, there are few possibilities. In the beginner's mind, there are many. And other expressions like embrace uncertainty is something one of my teachers says. It's hard to do because you'll try to make a thing out of that, right? We'll all try to like make that into a thing. We're slippery, you know, we're just trying to get back to the... Did you ever play this game when you were growing up of like... there's two bases and you throw the ball and you just got to get to the base, but you got to run between the bases? And then if you get caught off the base, it's sort of a shorthand version of baseball.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That space between the bases where you're vulnerable, you know, is really... And then you try to get back to the base, which you could use as a metaphor for ego. You just want to get back to some place where you feel safe and predictable outcome, you know? So you have to be a little bit experimental, I think. I like people who are exploring and experimental. That's why I like music and art and jazz and things like that.
I think there's a training in getting used to being between the bases.
What would that be?
I think whatever way you're comfortable with, but being as systematic as possible about getting as comfortable as possible with discomfort and not knowing.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting thing to dissect what you just said, to get as comfortable as you can be with being uncomfortable. Isn't that what you just said?
Yes.
It's a koan.
Yes, it is. For me, it often takes the form of like, I have claustrophobia. So can I challenge that as much as possible? I have stage fright. So my entire career has been a challenge to that. And
do you have it right now?
No, not right now. Cause I'm in my house in my closet and you know, this is pretty comfortable, but anytime I have to go, like I found out the other day, I've got to go, I think like this coming Monday, I need to go on some local TV station and I'm already nervous. So, and that show will have fewer viewers than this show. I don't know why I'm nervous, but I was happy when I saw it on my calendar because, well, I was nervous when I saw it on my calendar and then happy because yeah, it's just another opportunity to get to challenge myself. And I see that as like a form of, this is a loaded phrase, but self-love. Or self-compassion. It is taking care of yourself because your life gets smaller and smaller if you're not doing that.
Yeah. And that, you know, some in some iterations, we call that the warrior's path, you know, the path of warriorship, bravery, rising to the challenge. And there are practices that I learned, like called wind horse, where you do raise your confidence level through kind of almost psychophysical exercise. But it goes with, interesting, it's completely linked with softening. There's this part of it where you just have to open and soften. And the part that is so beautiful to link with that is being curious. So I like to say to people, yeah, you're making a challenge, but you're also being curious about what happens. And when you're curious, the world shifts a little bit. And, you know, like, what am I feeling when I feel claustrophobic? Not just it's bad, but what exactly is that experience? Become familiar with that experience. So, you know, they say, you know, exploring fear, not knowing the nature of fear, you can't really experience fearlessness. That's the way I was taught it. So fear is good from that point of view.
Yes, yes.
It's useful, but not if it tightens you up and, you know, you can't check into it further. But what we're talking about is huge stuff. As far as I'm concerned, having that kind of fear, whatever makes, you know, some people are afraid of heights, some people are afraid of violence, some people are afraid of intimacy. Having that kind of fear is almost a mark of being a human being, don't you think?
Absolutely. I guess what was coming up in my mind, and I don't know if this is a non sequitur, but I was just thinking about, like, any time I feel, I try to make a practice of this, to be clear, I fail the vast majority of the time. But when I'm on my game, anytime I feel fear, dismissiveness, denial, rushing, anything that's quote unquote unpleasant, usually that's a sign that there's something going on that I'm not looking at.
It lives. Remember that movie, It Lives? It's a science fiction. It's alive. It's a sign that you're alive. And that's, you know, you had Pema Chodron on your, yes, on your podcast several weeks ago.
Yes. Yeah.
She's kind of a genius in this space that we're talking about right here. She's not really, you know, all the time presenting like the nature of mind and the kind of, you know, more. She's saying what is happening in that space is something that you can become more familiar with and more friendly with. And I think that's why she reaches a lot of people, because it's not that climb every mountain kind of spirituality. It's like explore the valley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Didn't she write a book called The Wisdom of Insecurity?
Well, and the one I was thinking about, and the one we use in our course, is The Wisdom of No Escape, which is kind of an interesting original book. But there's a teaching that you might have been exposed to. It's called Shenpa in the Tibetan tradition. Shenpa, have you ever heard about that?
No.
And it's, you actually use the trigger, like a fear or, you know, a habitual pattern that comes on real tight and real fast and real strong. And that's what reminds you to open up. So it's using the trigger as an alarm clock, which is very sophisticated in a way.
Yes.
And it's just what you're saying. Hey, something's happening here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. My suffering is because there's something going on that I'm not looking at. This little expression came to me on meditation retreat a while ago, that if I'm suffering, there's something I'm not being mindful of.
Or aware of. Could you say aware of?
Yeah. Aware of.
Yeah. You know, in the awakening from the daydream, in the six realms, that is the root cause of the suffering, is avidya or non-awareness. You black out. You literally pass out. Your awareness goes blank and you wake up into a world that is dualistic and needs all kinds of supply lines and kind of confirmations to continue to develop. That original moment of passing out is called avidya marigpa in Tibetan. And it's just a loss of awareness. That is the root cause of suffering in terms of the Buddhist analysis. So from my point of view, you're exactly right about that. But it's fast. That's the one thing they don't tell you about. It happens really quick, like that.
Coming up, David talks about more Nickturnisms and Buddhist slogans to help you infuse your spirituality into work.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/happier. Just go to Indeed.com/happier right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/happier. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Audible lets you enjoy all your audio entertainment in one app. You will always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. They offer an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. What I've been checking out recently is called Our Share of Night. It's technically, I guess, a horror, but it's definitely literature. I mean, it's incredibly well written, absolutely fascinating. And it really does rhyme with some of the themes that we explore on this show. I highly recommend it, although I'm only through the first 15-20% of it. But already, I highly recommend it. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500. That's audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/10%. All right, well, we're going to cover like a tiny fraction of the Nick Turnisms I was hoping to get to. But let's keep soldiering through and see how many we can get to. One of them on the list is don't take yourself too seriously. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, maybe the right reading of it is don't take yourself too seriously. You know, that notion that there's some fixed big entity that is going to win or lose. When you're obsessed with winning or losing, you're taking yourself too seriously. When you're terrified, you're taking yourself too seriously. When you're experiencing aggression or grasping, you're taking yourself too seriously. It's too focused on the notion of a self. So I would say, I think I quoted Bruce Lee there, who, by the way, was a great, incredible teacher in a way. But when he says, be like water, you know, that would be the notion of just flowing a little bit more, which means you could laugh at yourself. You can appreciate a mishap or a mistake and go, you know, I'm not going to bury myself alive and cover my face with honey and invite a whole bunch of red ants to eat me alive because I just made a simple mistake. You can afford to be embarrassed. It's not that big a deal. You can tell somebody you love them, even if you don't know what they're going to say back, just like that kind of stuff.
All right, I'm going to keep going. Here's another slogan from you. Don't bring things to a painful point.
Yeah, so that is a Lojong slogan. I think you know the Lojong. It's mind training. Lo is mind and Zhong is like cultivation. And Pema teaches that quite a lot, but that's a Mahayana teaching already. Don't bring things to a painful point. Somebody's having a hard time, you know, give them a little break. You know, it's like if you're having a hard time. So it means not to stab yourself with reality and just kind of mutilate. Because it could be an accurate perception even, but don't bring it to the point where you're causing harm with the clarity of your perceptions or your aggression. So yes, lighten up everybody.
That seems like one that's easier said than done, because I mean, we've talked about noxious implications or ideas that we imbibe from the culture and being hard on yourself, pushing, the always behindness, never enoughness. It's a hard one to get past.
Everybody's talking about it too. You know, there are waveforms that go through our communities, you know, of like topics, like trauma is a big topic right now. Yeah, we are arguably have been trained to be our inner voice, to be harsh and critical. And with that, there comes a certain sense of like dominance and accomplishment that maybe has a positive energy to it. If you can liberate it from the negative self-talk and just feel like, yeah, I could do this. But always using a metric to evaluate how well you're doing seems to be like a doomed perspective. You should just do your best. That's what you should, exactly what you should do. Do your best and try again.
Try again. That might be worth saying a little bit more about.
It seems like you always have another opportunity to confront the same or a similar situation. Like here, I'll give you an example. So I'm in a leadership role. I don't remember really aspiring to that, but I always end up sort of being the producer or the person putting this stuff together. So I'm too harsh on people sometimes. I'm too fast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I push people too hard and they go, come on, this is clear. This is obvious. Don't take 10 minutes to say something that should take 30 seconds. So you got to know yourself. And then I think then the next time I meet with that person, I can take a slightly softer approach and more patient, but maybe deliver the message without the same amount of heat and aggression and spin. You always have another chance that way. You're married, right?
I am married. Yes.
That's how about that for another chance every day?
Yeah. Until she kicks me out of the house. Absolutely. Another chance every day.
I don't see it.
No, I don't see it happening either. I'm being facetious. But you're absolutely right. I heard a great thing once that somebody's shrink said to them. This person I know was in seeing their shrink and complaining about something that they had done. So the patient was complaining to the shrink about this pattern that they just fell into again. Can you believe I did it again? And the shrink said, was it as bad as it was the last time?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, that's called the gradual path, right? You know, we have the sudden path and the gradual path as part of the Buddhist tradition. That's a gradual path, just gradually training, kind of using the repetitive nature of reality to learn a little bit each time with the intention of shifting something, of transforming something. And then we also have the sudden path, which is just like, I guess, the more Zen-like or, you know, the word Zen is Chan in Chinese, and it's Chen, like Dzogchen is that kind of sudden recognition of the nature of mind. That's what Dzogchen, I know you're interested in that topic, and Mahamudra. And it's suddenly waking up. It's just like there's no precedent to it. There's no gradual, there's nothing's repeating actually from that perspective. This is a fresh moment from that perspective. There's no past, there's no future. But then we return to the relative perspective, and so we gradually nudge ourselves towards enlightenment.
This is such an interesting subject that we've veered into here, this gradual versus sudden awakening. And again, this is not an area where I'm an expert at all, but my understanding is just chop wood, carry water, do the practice. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. If you spend too much time thinking about, am I going to get some bolt of insight or am I going to gradually get there? You know, one of my favorite expressions about this, it comes from Matthew Brensilver, a great teacher on the West Coast of the United States, who says, your progress is none of your business.
Well, that's kind of an absolute perspective, actually, in a way. If it's a gradual thing, then your progress is something that you can lightly track. You know, it's helpful actually to see, am I rowing in the right direction or not, if it's a gradual path. So, these two, this is, you know, probably we all have our favorite topics as we get into this stuff. Mine is absolute and relative truth or relational truth and the inseparability of those two.
Can you describe, because some people listening might not know the difference between absolute and relative truth.
Yeah. And you know, that's why talking about it is interesting. So, putting it simply, and it's a deep dive if you get into it, but absolute truth just means it's true. It is the way it is, and it doesn't have cause and conditions, and it's sort of, it can be experienced by us in different ways, but us experiencing impermanence is us experiencing absolute truth in a way. We can't change that. Absolute truth is not changeable, not negotiable, non-negotiable truth. And so, for example, from that perspective, ego is not an absolute truth. The notion of a fixed self that's kind of, you know, heavy and permanently true and reincarnating lifetime after lifetime and, you know, was Shakespeare one time and a snail the next lifetime, that does not hold up in the absolute truth that there's some kind of fixed migrating self. That's a big innovation by Buddha, Mr. Buddha, that there is no fixed permanent self, Atman or, you know, that kind of thing. Now, The relational truth is you wake up in the morning and you got to water your plants and you cook your egg the way you like it, you know, which is soft boiled, but with a, you know, 3-minute egg. And if you get a 4-minute egg, you're upset. That's not the absolute truth. But relationally, there's a certain navigation that's going on. And the fact that those two, you're not trying to bias towards one or the other, is the real clinker. That to me is like an eye-opening thing, that they're inseparable, which is the more sophisticated teaching about it. So you go, oh, I'm supposed to hold those two truths simultaneously, that there is no self, and yet I still have to go to the store and get some bagels for Sunday's brunch. Mm-hmm. How is that possible to hold those two? There's no you, but you're driving to the store.
Exactly. One of the analogies that sometimes gets used is like quantum physics. And this is a rough analogy, but if you think about these, I'm sitting in a chair, you're sitting in a chair. On one level, on the relative level, these are chairs. On an absolute level, it's mostly empty space and spinning subatomic particles. And I'm sitting in the chair, and I also know that it's on the most fundamental level insubstantial, and there's no core of chairness to this chair. And that's a rough analogy for, you know, living between these two paradoxical truths.
Well, and it's a fair metaphor. And to be clear about it, like, since we're talking within the Buddhist context, it's not the only framework in the world. But Buddha is looking, where does it hurt? Where does it, as you said, where does the suffering kick in? And you said it's when you start to kind of not pay attention or not be aware of what's happening right in front of you. You create a cascading effect of some kind of dysphoria, really. You're out of sync with reality. So all that these things are saying is these are enriching teachings. They're supposed to make you feel more, as you would say, happy, 10% happier, you know? And I told Ethan I was going to come on your program and say, we're changing Dharma Moon to 11% happier and we're going to put you out of business.
Go for it. Go for it. I need to be, that'll put me between the bases.
Yeah. You know, it's good. But that 10% happier is a relational truth comment, would you say?
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. On this subject of the absolute versus the relative, and it can sound a little esoteric, but one application of it, for me, it's been useful to apply it in a work context in that, yeah, on one level, like my career matters. And there's some argument to, you know, building your resume and building the making the projects you're doing successful, however you want to measure that. And then on some other level, it's all a dream. And so I actually think that holding these two things at the same time can help me do something that you mentioned earlier, which is not take myself or this whole enterprise too seriously.
Yeah, that's why they're inseparable, because if you lean, and that's why it's called the middle way, if you lean towards the absolute truth, you become what's called an eternalist in the Buddhist way of looking at it. You're looking for some ultimate solution, and the tendency is you go, well, that little stuff doesn't matter much. And you see a lot of spiritual people, they're going, that doesn't matter. Look at the guy, he's got this podcast, he's got this career, who cares? It's you know, it doesn't mean anything. That's the eternalist view. And the other extreme is you just go, no, that's all bullshit and woo-woo and new age gobbledygook. I got the real goods here. I've got, you know, $83,000 in my, you know, in my IRA account. You know, we just tuned up the car. And my kid is going to the best school. And you just invest completely in that reality. So the idea that they're in conversation with each other, I think, is the nuance that that I find appealing about it.
Yes. But I would argue that it's a conversation, and I suspect you'd agree with this, that this conversation actually has beneficial professional ramifications.
By me, it does. From my perspective, I see suffering in a lot of people. They just don't have that together, that part of their existence together. They either through lack of confidence, lack of training, or a misguided view, you know, that it doesn't matter, that it's not important, have ignored and not trained properly in that aspect of living. And I've seen considerable suffering caused by that. And then on the other hand, people who are totally immersed in the material world, who don't have a sense of, you know, openness or ease or spaciousness, also are suffering. That's been my life's experience, to see those two extremes and trying to come into the middle way about that. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. One thing we talked about earlier was this tendency that we have to be hard on ourselves, to be, my language, you know, an asshole to yourself. And so I'm curious, what is your advice for dealing with real world assholes who exist outside of our skulls, who can show up in a work context all too often? Are there, from a CSM standpoint, are there ways to deal with jerks?
Well, I know this isn't going to come out right, Dan, but even assholes are empty.
Yes. Empty is...
You could just leave it like that.
It's a Buddhist term of art, just for the listener. It's a Buddhist term of art for, you know, from an absolute standpoint, there's no essence there. So empty of essence.
Yeah. So, you know, do we run into difficult people from our point of view? Yeah, but it could be somebody's mother, you know, and they think somebody's son. Have you ever talked to somebody's mother who you think is an asshole and asked them, like, you know, your son's an asshole, right? You know that, don't you, Mom? And they go, who are you talking about? It's very relational, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and so it's worthy of a second look, but it's also worthy of using acuity, prajna, to discern what your interaction with them would be most skillful. What would be the right way for you to interact with somebody who's maybe causing harm or difficulties or obstacles for you or other people? It doesn't mean you should be a wuss. We talked about that earlier. You can be tough. You can be precise. You can be clear, but you don't need to memorialize assholeness. You know, there's no museum for it.
Meaning you don't need to impute some unchanging essence to somebody else. They are the way they are because of their causes and conditions. The question really is, how are you going to deal with it?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, isn't that the only choice we really have?
Yeah, and yet it's interesting for me to reflect on how I, as an alleged Buddhist, run afoul of that injunction. You know, like I, in my mind, am putting people in the asshole category, even though I know it's all empty, it's all insubstantial, but it's a habit that's hard to break.
Yeah. You know, Ethan Nickturn on his podcast, The Road Home, if it's okay to say that, the last talk he gave was on basic goodness, which is a really profound topic related to what we're talking about now. And it's a really good iteration of the premise that permeating our entire reality is some kind of wholesome, potentially really, really ripe, beautiful, expansive, informative, brilliant quality called basic goodness. And I also share that view. So even assholes have basic goodness would be the way you'd have to say it in the terms of what we're talking about now. But I like the even assholes are empty. I like that better today.
All right, we only have a few minutes left here. So let's pick one last topic. I'm picking somewhat at random, but these are the words that are screaming out to me from my list of questions in front of me. One of, and I want to say again, we've touched on a minority of the very interesting points that you make in this one of your books. But one of the things you talk about is the importance of being daring. You call it the dignity of outrageous. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that comes from a particular teaching, which is sort of the warriorship path. A good book on that is Shambhala, The Sacred Path of the Warrior by Chogyam Trungpa, if somebody wants to get tuned into that kind of perspective. And in training a warrior, you cultivate certain qualities which start with humility. That's the first one, and it's symbolized by a tiger. And then the snow lion symbolizes a kind of perky or, you know, sort of game, playful kind of energy. And then the outrageous or daring is symbolized by a Garuda. These are ancient, you know, symbols that are everywhere around Asia. And somewhere in the West, too, there's corollaries to it. But the outrageous one is like the celestial hawk. The Garuda doesn't need to land. It's airborne. It's like refueling in the air, like a 747, you know. And that means it doesn't need to be confirmed all the time. It doesn't need, oh, good boy, good girl, you know, you did it well. It doesn't need confirmation. You know how people give you confirmation? You don't need that anymore. And in the outrageous, there's just a sense of spontaneity that is governing. And you trust yourself and you trust the situation. But it's pretty advanced in a way, because most of us doubt ourselves. So then you go back to the kind of trap of doubt. And then if we're not paying attention, you go back to the mindfulness exercise. So it's a way to calibrate certain aspects of your path. And you can think about this, Dan, I'm sure, at times where you just took a leap. I bet you did. And you just went, I'm going, I'm doing this. I'm going here, I'm doing that. I'm going to talk to this person. I'm going to start this podcast, whatever it was. There's a leap involved. No?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't know where I'm thinking about that. And I'm like, where does that confidence come from? Because I definitely am not the celestial hawk who doesn't need to land and get pellets of affirmation from literally anybody who's willing to offer me one.
Are you sure?
Nothing in my life has indicated that I am immune to affirmation.
Have you always sought affirmation at every stage of every adventure?
No. No, and I guess that's true even right now. I'm thinking about the biggest creative project on my plate right now is been working on a book for 5 or 6 years and nobody's seen it for the last year and a half because I've been rewriting it and I haven't been like every day showing a new sentence to my wife. So yes, I guess it's true.
And at some point you'll take the leap with it, right? Or not?
Yes. The whole thing is a leap because, you know from writing a book, but from writing several books that it's a leap. And in this case, I'm investing an enormous amount of time. So there's a huge opportunity cost and I'm willing to do that because I don't know where I'm getting the confidence or the willingness to make this leap because there's actually not a lot of confidence in there. I can't pound the table and tell you this book is any good. I just know I kind of feel like I have to do it.
There's a little Garuda, a little baby Garuda in there, isn't there?
I guess so. Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah. And, you know, there's another chapter in the book and, you know, I don't know if this one appealed to you or not. It's called Don't Polish a Turd. Did you see that one?
Yes, it does appeal to me. Yes. Please say more.
It's kind of one of my favorites. And I'll tell you where I got that from. I was doing the music for a couple of soap operas for a while in New York. And I was doing the music for One Life to Live. And the producer, Linda Gottlieb, who was the producer of that movie, Dirty Dancing, and she'd just come off of that. She used to say that to us. We'd work on a music cue for a long time and change the bass line and change this and change that. And she'd say, stop polishing a turd. At a certain point, you go, I'm not going to finish this. I'm going to start something else or fresh. So that's the counterpoint to that. And that's common sense. But a lot of us think our first draft, we're polishing a turd, and that's too soon.
Yes.
Too early. You got to find the right moment to stop polishing a turd or to take the leap. So I guess Garuda on one end, turd polishing on the other end, you figure it out. In between there, something good is happening.
The key words there are you figure it out. And I guess that goes back to doing the basic wood chopping of having a mindfulness practice to be awake and aware so that you have some, you know, intuition for this.
Well, mindfulness, in which our whole platform at Dharma Moon is based on mindfulness, but there's a lot more to the Buddhist arc than mindfulness. It's really a foundational practice. And compassion, you know, a skillful means. There's a lot of cultivations that go from it. None of it gets to first base without mindfulness. Like I say, you know, in baseball, you know, you want to get the first batter is somebody who can get onto first, whether they're small and they can walk or they can sneak their way to it or hit a little dribble ball and get on there. Mindfulness is a little bit like that. You need to get on base. But I would say if people just stop there and think mindfulness is the whole iteration of the path, they're missing opportunities to go further.
Yes. Well, that's certainly been my experience. Before I let you go, two little questions. One is, and this might not be a little question, but is there something you were hoping to talk about that we didn't get to?
I think I would like to invite people to come check us out, dharmamoon.com. So that's something that me and a lot of people, including Ethan and a lot of the other people, are putting a lot of energy and effort into it. And we have a great mindfulness meditation teacher training, and we've trained thousands of teachers. I think that's a specialty of what I have to offer at this point in my life, particularly training the next generation of teachers. So I guess getting a little, you know, word in about that would be it. And otherwise, I just got to say, it's refreshing talking to you.
Thank you.
It's like, for me, my experience was like drinking cool water. It feels fresh and clean and honest. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this way. Thank you.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it as well. And you did me a favor because you answered the second question I was going to ask you, which is I was going to try to get you to plug what you're working on. So you mentioned Dharma Moon, but maybe also mention again the names of your two books.
Yeah. So the one we've been talking about is Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck. And that's about the integration of the three principles, as we discussed. They're both on Wisdom Publications, and they're both available as audiobooks that I read. And that one is also available as a downloadable video series on our website, dharmamoon.com. And the first book I wrote was called Awakening from the Daydream, which is about the Buddhist Wheel of Life. It's a re-examination in contemporary terms of the six realms and kind of beautiful description of karma. And I tried to make it very contemporary and up to date so people could access the information without getting lost in the museum aspect of the whole thing. So those are the two books. And, you know, I'm spinning out from what impressed me early on at this point. I'm going with teachings I learned very early in the early 70s because that's what made a dent in my flow. And so I'm trying to like kind of relay those along to the next generation. That's my objective right at this point. And have fun. That's what we say. That's important.
Agreed. David, it was fun to talk to you. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to David Nickturn. A couple of things to say here before I let you go. I put some links in the show notes to a podcast episode I did with Ethan Nickturn, David's son. Also a podcast episode I did with Duncan Trussell, who's a great comedian and podcaster and is a student of David's. So those links are in the show notes. Also, just want to remind you, David has a book called Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck. That book is also a podcast and a video series. So we'll put links to those in the show notes. And finally, this summer, he's doing something called the Summer 100-Hour Mindfulness Teacher Training. It doesn't start until June 14th, but we'll put a link if you want to sign up for that. 10% Happier is produced by Gabrielle Zuckerman, Justine Davey, Lauren Smith, and Tara Anderson. DJ Kashmir is our senior producer. Marissa Schneiderman is our senior editor. Kevin O'Connell is our director of audio and post-production. And Kimmy Regler is our executive producer. Alicia Mackey leads our marketing. And Tony Magyar is our director of podcasts. And Nick Thorburn of Islands wrote our theme. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully, no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.